This summer, we're collecting materials, conducting research, interviewing people such as yourself that were involved.
Is your some employment?
Yes.
And yours?
Yes.
Okay. Where are you from?
I'm from New York City.
And you?
I'm also from New York City.
Okay.
I just graduated, so I'm working as Dr. Dorsey's research assistant this summer.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So this summer, we're going to create an archive of primary source materials and interviews and firsthand accounts. And in the fall, there's going to be a class taught by Dr. Dorsey that's going to focus on this event. And students are going to go through the materials that we've put together and sort of create their own historical narratives of what happened based on these primary source documents.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So where do you want to start?
Well, do you have any more questions about the class or about?
No, I think is the purpose to just reconstruct. I think it lay dormant for a long time. It was probably the only university activity that wasn't written up, or it was covered extensively in Life magazine, and there were some other newspapers eclipsed, but there's been nothing on the part of Swarthmore, I don't think, to
exactly,
even
yeah.
acknowledge that it happened.
Exactly. Our college is celebrating 150 years, and Dr. Dorsey, along with some of her colleagues, thought that this was a really important part of Swarthmore's history that needed to, resurface or needed to be taught to current students of the college.
It was a shock at the time that this was happening at Swarthmore. That's why there was an air of disbelief on the part of a lot of people and supporters of Swarthmore that they thought they were above the fray.
Yeah.
And so that's why it was amazing to see the response to it.
Yeah. So our first question is, through your work in Chester and as the director of the Media Fellowship House, you connected with the students who formed the Swarthmore Afro-American Student Society,
mm-hmm.
also known as SAS. And just to start off, how do you remember your relationships with the Black Swarthmore students during that time period?
Well, I was very active in helping with civil rights demonstrations and activities in both Westchester, Pennsylvania, Media, and Chester. But Chester was the real center of activity. And the SAS students were very much involved in helping out in the Chester low-income community. They were mentoring kids, bringing some of them on campus, and they really got themselves deeply involved in the life of the community. So they had established some real strong bonds. But they were also very active with the service personnel on campus, the janitors and the people worked in the kitchen, and embraced them. Almost as a part of it. So they had a really solid relationship with the students, and so I sort of met them through this relationship because I'd been serving low-income leaders. Part of my work in civil rights wasn't just to confront racism, but confront challenges within low-income communities, which I thought was a shortcoming of the civil rights movement because it concentrated almost exclusively on race. At the expense sometimes of looking at non-racial problems that existed in the community. So I was involved in that. So that's how I met the SAS students.
So at some point the SAS students approached you about what they were planning to do. So can you tell us about those early planning meetings?
Yeah.
Like how did you guide them through those early stages?
Well, when they first came to me and told me what their plans were, I said to them that they're welcome to use my office as a staging area and a place to meet and organize it. And I just sort of gave them some guidance. I said that if you're going to do this, it's important to do it with dignity and nonviolently so that the issue stays focused and not on your aberrant behavior. And I told them at the time that once this becomes public, there'll be people who will be drawn to you, who will try to use them. for their own purposes in the name of helping them. And that it was very important for them to remain separate from them and keep them away from me, and I would help with that. So that was my advice to the students, and so the whole takeover was coordinated out of my office. Because I remember we actually had a board in there where when the takeover was to occur, what was to happen, who was supposed to do it, and then what was the sort of occupation strategy. How were the students going to be fed? We have arranged for grassroots people in Chester to cook and provide meals that were brought in every day and passed through the window. And also, I sort of set up a command center at my office so that the parents of the students had a place to call and stay abreast of activities so that they will know that their children were safe and that they were being responsible. And so my staff and me at the office, we played that role at the time. And so during the negotiations, we just sort of played a backroom role with them, but they were the ones who, and we helped them shape their demands. But essentially, all we did was provide the framework, the content of what the demands were and all of that, strictly the students. We just served as a servant role and as to protect them. And so when the announcement was made, and we also helped in the coordination of the press releases to make sure that every aspect of it reflected these principles of not attacking people, but attacking issues, and also being respectful during negotiations, and also to incorporate the needs of non-students in this as well, and the kitchen personnel and whatnot. And the students had also developed relationships because they used to do the income tax returns for some of the personnel, service personnel on campus. So that's kind of the background about how we, the flow between us and the parents. I talked to a lot of parents, I had everyone's phone number, and the parents had the phone number at the Media Fellowship House. And so we would like the command center.
So you said that SAS members were the ones that wrote the demands, but that you helped them shape them. So can you tell us more about what was your opinion of the goals that motivated SAS?
They were all noble. I think what they were talking about, I think Asman Legesse was the only black faculty member, and he was Ethiopian, I think anthropologist, I believe. Yeah. And they wanted more black faculty. They wanted, I guess, like administrators, just to desegregate Swarthmore. it's what was everybody was demanding at the time, to desegregate the campus. They wanted, more done to attract more minority students. They were not asking for a lowering of standards. They were just asking to be more inclusive. I think they were asking for scholarships for students. I'm not clear about the details. It's been a long time. But I think that was the general gist of what, I mean, they were not unreasonable demands.
Yeah, certainly. Do you
want to
go ahead with the next question?
Okay. So you were talking about your office being the command center. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that worked logistically, about your office helping coordinate the communication between students and their parents? Because they were in there for some time and there were things happening outside. We heard that one young woman had a relative die in a
killed,
standoff.
Yeah. What happened was, during the time, I had spent some time in California, and I knew some of the people involved in that incident. And Lucy and I had spent three summers before. I spent a whole summer with groups, activist groups in Pasadena, California, and I knew all of the activists out in Los Angeles, so I knew a lot of the people out there. And there were some real severe differences between the US organization, run by Ron Karenga, and Huey Newton's group, the Black Panther Party. And there were severe differences, and it got so. And I think I talked to Clinton Etheridge not too long. He reminded me of the name of the young lady, but he knows it, the name of the young lady whose her cousin was a student at UCLA, and he was the one who was shot to death on campus. And the mother called me right as soon as it happened and asked me would I get over to the campus to have the daughter, it was her first cousin, call the mother before she saw it on the news. And as I rushed over to campus, it was just being reported in the news, and she lost it in the she saw pictures of her cousin being carried out shot. So I just comforted her, and then we arranged for her mom to come down and pick her up. So we arranged for her to get to the airport, and so she would get home to be with the family. So that was one of the very unfortunate situation, but that's the role we played. The mother had no other way of calling, so the mother and father called us, and then we rushed over there and told them what happened. But that was the role we were playing, to kind of to the comfort in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when President Courtney Smith suffered a fatal heart attack, SAS ended the occupation, they left campus, and they stayed at the Media Fellowship House. Mm-hmm. This is correct?
Yeah, what happened was, but even before that, I think is something else you should know. There are two groups that tried to almost use SAS to turn that demonstration into something else, and that was the Weather Underground. They were on campus, white radical leftist group came on, and also the Black Panthers tried to come and co-opt it. But I brought a friend of mine, Jim Woodruff. He was Episcopal priest, was very well-known Black Episcopal priest, and a very forceful leader in the Black Power movement in Philadelphia, who was a good friend of mine. And so to kind of blunt that, I brought him on campus, and he met the students early, and he was just well known and well respected by everybody. And so Jim and I agreed that we had to protect the students from both the Panthers and the Weather Underground. And so that the students listened to us and told them that they didn't want their help. So this first, the students just told them we didn't want their help, because they really wanted to turn it, some of them, into something violent, and that's what they wanted. But the students listened to us and just kept it that way. And then when Courtney Smith died, I think he was 46 years old, and he had the heart attack, and the students called and said, what should we do? Well, first of all, we said that we're going to call a moratorium. It's not ending, but there was to be a moratorium. And we wrote a press release that says, we mourn for the death of Courtney Smith the way you mourn for the death of kids in the inner city, and that we should, you know. And so what happened, I think there were some members of the football team and others who really wanted to take violent action against the students. So to neutralize that, I called a lot of the fellas in the community to come up and protect the students. And so we said to them, it's important for you to leave the facility and come to my office. That way it'll just keep tensions. So rather than having the fellas from Chester come and perhaps get in a violent confrontation with the students, it's better if the students would leave. So I've arranged for 10 cars to come up, caravan on campus, and two of the cars collected their luggage, and the other eight, the students filled those. But these men also made certain that there were no confrontation between the students, athletes, and the kid, and the young people. They made sure they were protected. So we caravaned out, and we also said to them, it is important to leave the office the way you found it. And the students cleaned it, put everything back in place, and left. And of course, the photographers came, rushed in, and the Philadelphia Daily News reported that the students had trashed the office, and so it was first reported that they trashed it, which was a lie. But then other television stations and others came out and corrected it, and they showed pictures of everything in order. And so we sort of went into a retreat for about 2 days where we had some sessions talking about where do we go from here, and the state of the movement and what have you. And I remember saying to Clint and others, the question is, do they go to the memorial service? I said, it's absolutely necessary for you to show your respect and go to the memorial service. So I picked up Clint and Don Mizell.
That's his name.
Yeah, Don Mizell. I think he was a cousin to my first wife.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Don Mizell is my first wife's cousin. I said, I will come and take you to, because Don was really one of the leaders, and Clint was the public spokesperson, because Don had more of an organization personality. And so I remember taking him to the memorial service and sitting on the front row, and we said we wouldn't comment to the press, but that they would just have a presence there. And just having their presence there really won over a lot of students. A lot of the bitterness and rancor that was attending the right after the word of his death was just really neutralized by Don Mizell and Clint coming to the memorial service. And that sort of set the tone, and a lot of students were coming up praising them for coming to the memorial service and showing the respect for Courtney Smith and talking about how they mourned his death and only the best for his family and whatnot. And I sort of, after that, my kind of role just kind of ended with the students, and I think, I don't think they took up the occupation again, but I think negotiations continued between the students and the faculty, and some changes were made, and what. So I sort of ended my participation right after that, Courtney Smith died. But my participation was very active up and from the beginning, during the prelude, and then at the end, that was it.
So just to backtrack a little bit so that I can understand what happened right after Courtney Smith's death, how many students left campus with the cars that you organized?
All of them.
All of them?
All of the students.
All of the SAS students all or all of SAS, the black
no,
students?
No, it's a good question. I was only involved with the SAS students. Most of the black students were in SAS. There were like four or five who refused, but then the white students distanced themselves from those students, and that kind of radicalized them. I remember four students in the lunchroom, I was told, and other white students asked them why they weren't with SAS, and they said, oh, they don't agree with SAS, and so they just got up and left them. because they said, well, we can't respect you if you can't even respect your own folks. So that's caused some of those four students to join SAS at that point. I mean, there weren't that many black students on campus at the time, so I think all of them were a part of the demonstration. I don't know if there may have been one or two that weren't, but I don't recall, but I think 99% of the black students were a part of SAS.
So
if they're not Mormon, they were supportive.
Sorry to interrupt. So all of the SAS students leave campus, and only Don Mizell and Clinton Etheridge attend the memorial service?
Yes, they were there to represent SAS. They, just the two of them came to the... we didn't want to create a spectacle of all the students coming on. Then, you know, we just felt that they just needed, the leadership needed to be represented. So they were representing all the students.
And did you stay with them throughout that event?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I drove them there. Stayed with them and stayed in the background. I never made any public statements. That wasn't my role. They were the ones who engineered it. They were the ones who shaped it, provided the content. I just supplied logistical support and tactical suggestions, and that's all, just kind of coaching them on the tone and acting to protect them, because they had no way of knowing about the weatherman and all. But having Jim Woodruff there serve to reduce any possibility of confrontation between us and those two groups, because Jim Woodruff, and we had a real strong following in the community. I did, and Jim Woodruff was a very influential social force in Philadelphia at the time. A lot of people listened to him.
Just to back up quickly, were the SAS members who didn't go to the service still at the Media Fellowship House, or were they?
Yes, they were at Media Fellowship House. All of them, all of their belongings, their clothes, and personal effects were done. The Media Fellowship House had a big at the time, a very large recreation room where there were showers, and because it was Quaker oriented, and so it was really built to house. It was an old mansion that was modified. That we had a huge dining hall with bathrooms and showers to accommodate the weekend work campers who came in from around the country. So the facility was just perfectly suited for them. We just put sleeping bags all over the floor, and everyone had plans to sleep, and it was sanitary, and we supplied meals for them.
How long were they there for?
I would say 4 or 5 days till the memorial service was over. And then right after that, they began to move back on campus. Maybe 2 or 3 days, not very long. But I think as soon as the memorial service is over and there was a level of camaraderie among the SAS students, and as they began to filter back on campus, old friendships began to get reestablished, but they still were engaged in negotiation with the administration over their demands. They never did drop their demands, nor did they pull back from them. But so I have no idea what happened after that. How many were met? I just sort of, my role was to get them through that. That's what they asked me to do, and I limited it. I limited my role to what they asked me to do and the things that I felt I needed to do to protect them. And I think it was one of the few takeovers in the country that remained peaceful and dignified. The others at Columbia and other places, just students were arrested and violence and people were gassed and cops came on campus. There were some people killed. So Swarthmore was, I think, one of the few that proceeded the way that it did.
Don Mizell said something similar at an alumni weekend event that happened a couple of weeks ago. He said he was pleasantly surprised that SAS's protest wasn't met with more of a violent reaction. And I was wondering if you could talk more about threats of violence or violence that you were worried could happen when SAS decided to occupy Parish Hall.
The concern that I had was not from SAS members, but that on our side, that people like the Weather Underground and the Black Panthers, because what they do is they come in and seize situations in the name of helping you, but end up, and a lot of people that they encounter are naive. They're not sophisticated enough to see through all of the trappings of revolution and all this kind of stuff. They were not sophisticated enough to see through it. We were. And so the danger came from outside, but it also came from inside. Students, particularly student athletes, who felt offended by all of this. And I'm sure there were some Klan elements in the larger community that perhaps would have come, I don't know too much about that, but I'm sure, but my experience that there was a lot of Klan activity in Westchester where we did our demonstration. So all that whole area of Delaware and Chester County, we knew that there was always the threat that white supremacists would come and take advantage of the tensions. They were always looking for flashpoints. And so we had to be vigilant about the threat from within and the threat from without. And so we were certain by having the proper external leaders like Jim Woodruff and myself at the helm of this, and also Diane Palm and Bob Johnson. These were prominent community leaders in Chester who were well known. The very fact that they had a presence with the students really served to fend off anybody that would attempt to use it and turn it into something violent. So it was an impromptu, spontaneous wall of protection that we built around the students that even they weren't aware of. But at least they trusted me that anyone that I brought to the table, they felt confident that they would be operating in their interest.
Can you talk more about that outside influence that you were worried was going to hurt SAS's goals?
Yeah, there are people, I mean, in the movements at those times, you had all kinds of radical, you had the two percenters, these were just anarchists. There are people, they were more on the West Coast than out on the East Coast, but there were people who believe in radical revolution and in anarchy. I have been personally involved, and I wrote about stopping a riot when they actually tried to firebomb a chemical plant right in the middle of the Black community, even though it was going to destroy a lot of Black families. But they felt it would inflame the passions of Blacks who would then react and create a race war. I mean, there was just some crazy people around. And so I had personal experiences seeing radicals on the left and radicals on the right. So you had the two percenters, you had the Weather Underground, white radical groups who bombed libraries at Harvard and shot at police officers and did all kinds of things. Symbolese Revolutionary Army in San Francisco that killed Marcus Foster, a Black principal, because he was requiring students to have identification badges in order to be on campus. They felt this was fascist. And so you had, at that time, a lot of crazy elements operating around the civil rights movement. Anytime you had a demonstration where there was a takeover, there was always a danger of it devolving into a violent confrontation. You had to work hard every day to make certain that that it had to stay. And the secret was having strong leadership. And Clint and Don Mizell and the students were clear that that's what they wanted, that they didn't want this other stuff. But they weren't, I think, knowledgeable enough to know what help they should receive and what they shouldn't. But they listened to us, and as a result of this relationship, you know, it was fine.
And you, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Could you maybe give us some more details of what the specific advice you gave them about how to navigate those outsiders was? Sort of how are you suggesting that they handle that?
Stay away from them. Tell them when they come and offer help, no thank you. Don't start the conversation in the first place. When they say, well, we want to come and help, no thanks, we have our own advisors. Can we come to meetings? No. Meetings are closed. Can we help you with some money or something? No, we don't need your help. You can't accept, I just said to them, you cannot accept any help at all of any kind.
Yeah.
Even to engage in discussion, just say no, thank you, and just turn and walk away. And that's what we did. They will ask, can I address the group? No. You cannot address the group. You cannot appear at any meetings. It's total isolation. You got to just not give them any pretense for coming and taking over or participate. Just total isolation. And I said, if there's any threats or any kind, let us take care of that. But when you have a strong, when people see who's standing with you, it serves to neutralize that. So you don't have confrontation. If the composition of the people around you is strong enough, you don't have confrontation. And they have no way of knowing that. But those of us who've been in the streets knew that, and so that's the expertise that we brought to the table. We know how to keep people away from them. But they had to cooperate. They had to agree to do it. And what I love about SAS, they were not interested in just getting headlines, which a lot of people get involved and they take themselves a little too seriously, and then they get caught up in the media hype, but SAS never did. They were more interested in content and not making headlines.
So earlier you contrasted the influence of these outside activists with the influence of community members, such as Mr. Woodruff. And I was wondering if there were other ministers or churches or people in the community who supported SAS or who worked with SAS.
I didn't know any others. All the people that I know helped that were a part of our movement were all neighborhood leaders. Diane Palm, who I'm still close to, she lives in Houston, Texas now. She was a teacher, and we ran a program called Community Assistance Program. We helped ex-offenders on the streets. So Diane was very happy, and Bill Sanders, and there were about 10 people who were very active in Chester at the time, but they were part of, supportive of SAS. So that was sort of our group. And these are the people who know people, so that I can, in 10 minutes when Courtney Smith died, I had within a half an hour, 10 people identified with cars ready to come up on campus. And I think that people like the Panthers knew we had that kind of influence also. So they didn't challenge us. But we couldn't have done it if SAS wasn't cooperative, if they were not coachable. And they were always very, very coachable. An intelligent person knows their limits. And a secure person knows their limits, and they were all, I think, very intelligent and secure in who they were. And not a single one of them, I think, ever just wanted to make headlines. That's what I found easy to deal with SAS.
And earlier you mentioned that SAS had a good relationship with the Black staff members on campus. Mm-hmm. And we actually found a document titled Open Letter to the Parents of Black Students of Swarthmore College, which was signed by a few Black staff members, specifically William and Eileen Klein, Edwin and Delois Collins, Harold Hoffman, Robert and Lee Williams, and Rachel Williams. And I'm just wondering if you remember any of these people, remember the kind of relationship that SAS had with the staff, Black staff at on campus.
I really didn't even know any of the Black staff, but I heard because some of them lived in Chester. The word I got on the street was, the reason that the community supported them is because they supported some of the Black staff and never acted as if they were better than them because they were at Swarthmore. They never took themselves too seriously because they were students at Swarthmore. And that helped a great deal. They obviously didn't get in a class divide. The reason there was so much affection between the low-income neighborhood leaders. Chester, remember, is one of the most poorest communities in the state. And so for SAS to have a good, solid relationship with people like that was pretty amazing at the time.
Do you think it was risky for these staff members to openly express their support for
SAS? Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was risky for them. And that's why I think SAS wanted to make sure that they were protected by including them in it, that anything that happened to these staff members happened to a staff. I haven't seen that happen before. A lot of these movements are just self-centered and was not expansive to include others, you know. That's what, again, what was unique about the SAS movement. They were very, very inclusive in terms of class, very, very inclusive.
Can I move up to question six?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to? Sure. So we were reading that on January 10th, the day after the sit-in started, SAS representatives Clinton Etheridge and Don Mizell met with President Smith's assistant Gilmore Stott at the Media Fellowship House.
Mm-hmm.
And we were reading, according to the campus paper, it said that the press conference was open to any press person, but that you had asked that they not come into the meeting between the SAS representatives and Mr. Stott. Is that an accurate portrayal?
Yeah. Yeah, when you're negotiating, you want people to negotiate on issues.
Yeah.
And not get sidetracked by trying to pitch the press. It's very bad to have press in when you're negotiating because you're going to be changing your mind, you're going to be shifting around, and you don't want people to play to the press.
Yeah.
Then you can make a statement afterwards. But I thought it the worst thing in the world is to have a press in when you're negotiating.
Yeah. Had you been in contact with Swarthmore administrators before that? Were they familiar with you? Had you worked with them at all?
Not directly, but our reputation was pretty good in the area. I did a lot. The Media Fellowship House was started by Quakers, as was Swarthmore, and many of the members of the board of Swarthmore, some of them are Swarthmore trustees, some of them were either attended Swarthmore or who had kids in Swarthmore. So there was a symbiotic relationship between Media Fellowship House and Swarthmore. No formal relationship, but just an informal kind of, because the people went back and forth. The Biddle family from Bailey Banks and Biddle, they were one of the founders of Media Fellowship House. And I think a large supporter of Swarthmore, for example. And then a lot of the work camps. I was a member of the American Friends Service Committee and did a lot of work with the Friends Service Committee. So I knew Swarthmore people through, they knew me from American Friends Service Committee. And there's a retreat, I forgot the name of it, it's a Quaker retreat right in the area. And so I met Swarthmore faculty at these presentations at retreats and things like that. But that was about all. But I know everyone was in shock when this happened at Swarthmore. It was the biggest shock because of Swarthmore's liberal reputation. They just didn't expect it to happen. Mm-hmm. Interesting time.
Mm-hmm. So you were talking about organizing this luncheon and organizing the communication between staff students and their parents. How else was your office, was the command center, how else was your office supportive of SAS during the actual
just raise money to provide resources that they need for press releases and food, and we didn't have a budget for that. So people made donations to help them, and from Chester and from my organization. And so that's about it. Was pretty much limited to making our facility available to them. I think we did nothing else during that period but support SAS. I mean, all of our time and energy was spent helping them. We suspended everything else and just helped them.
And besides the Media Fellowship House, you were affiliated with CHIP during that time?
The what?
With CHIP? What was the other organization?
There were a couple other organizations, CHIP. I forgot what the acronym was, but I know that was in Chester. And there were CHIP, and there were quite a few organizations. You know, everybody had an acronym.
So these organizations were Media, Chester, and...
Chester, mostly.
Mostly Chester.
Yeah, Media is kind of a sleepy little middle and upper income enclave. I think South Media had a little small, but all the families go back centuries almost. You see the name of a black family, Darlington, and a white Darlington, then you see Darlington Road. Quakers, as you know, let their own slaves release them and then gave them land. So you have like Concord and all these little black enclaves that go back 200 years. All over that area. Interesting history. Some of the old mansions, you can just see the Underground Railroad, the tunnels that lead from a person's house out to the field.
Wow.
You can still see some of those in Wallingford and Chichester and all like that. Some of the old mansions maintained that antebellum kind of history there.
So I think we're getting ready to wrap this up, but I wanted to ask about sort of the end of the protest. You said that once President Courtney Smith passed away, that that was sort of the end of your
involvement.
But can you tell us if Black Swarthmore students continue to work in Chester, and if you continue to be involved with them through that space, like their mentoring?
No, I don't recall. I just know that we moved on to other things, other issues, since that. Our goal was just an ambulance service. So once the service was delivered,
once we all made out alive,
after everybody got out alive and everybody was talking and whatnot, we just kind of went to other things. I saw some of them. I left and went to work in Boston for 2 years, and I think Don was in Harvard Law School, and so I ran into Clint Etheridge and those who went to Harvard Law School, I saw them in Boston occasionally socially. But I remember they came up. Most of them went to law school, I think. Marilyn Hollifield.
Yeah.
And Don Mizell, I know, went to Harvard because I used to see him at my office. And I don't know where Clint went, someplace. But I know Don and Marilyn Hollifield came to Boston. But that was it. Again, mine was an ambulance service.
Do you have any other questions, Allie?
I don't.
Is there anything else that you want to make sure we make a note of? Anything else that you think we didn't ask you about?
I wasn't clear what role Asmon Legesse, I know he was very, very nice guy. I don't know if he's still around or no, but he was an interesting guy. He was the only black faculty. He was very supportive. But no, that's about it. We just about covered everything, how we met, and then what our role was, what their role was, the incident involving the death. Then Courtney Smith. I think what's important for me that I remember most is just how sophisticated and self-confident the students were to be so young and not get caught up in the hype of the movement. Because a lot of people in movements get impressed with themselves when they're on television or in the newspapers. And that becomes an attraction and a distraction. And so they get defined by the distraction and not the content of what they were about. But SAS never wavered from that. And so I think that's why their movement was the subject of a Life magazine profile, because of how dignified the way they handle it. Columbia, you don't see anything about Columbia. That was a mess. So some students got barred forever from going to school, back to school. I knew some young people came through that. They never went back to college. That was it.
Well, thank you for your time. This has been really, really informative, and it's really wonderful to hear from someone who's there and who had a little more experience or had a little bit more wisdom to see what was going on during that time, because I'm sure it was an emotional, trying time for people involved in that protest. But thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, because a lot of people, again, like myself, who try to help people, they used them for their own purposes.
Yeah.
So they had to be careful. So I had to be an example of what I was telling them to avoid. And so I tried to be faithful to that, not get involved in determining what their demands were, or just being on tap and not on top. And that's very hard sometimes for people who try to help.